I would like to call the Senate Education Committee to order. My name is Dennis Linthicum. We will start real quick by getting a quick, easy bill out of the way. House Bill 2956, Rep. Wisnett, please come forward. And I will start by doing a open for House Bill 2956.
Oh, we can't get it out of the way. It's just a public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable committee members, including Senator Cruz. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. As the chair said, I believe it is a simple but a necessary bill. Recently, I was reading House Bill ORS 326.425, titled Early Learning Centers, describing the purpose and rules of the early learning centers, and discovered a statement that said no later than February the 1st, 2019, the council shall submit a report to the interim legislative committees on education and early learning regarding the findings and recommendations made as a result of the evaluation performed under this section. The Early Learning Division is a new function created in 2013 and has an overall 17-19 budget of $414,000. So I think that this bill provides some oversight of that agency. House Bill 2556 requires the Early Learning District to conduct an evaluation and submit a report of early learning hubs each odd year, and requires an additional evaluation report. There was actually an amendment to the bill, and we eliminated some duplications in my bill and what they were doing. So I think it's a good bill. It's a good transparency bill, and I would appreciate this committee approving. I think the Early Learning Council has concurred with the bill, and the reporting is required by that.
Now, that's the problem when you got people like him that actually read the ORSs, you find these things. So.
Nothing else to do in my life in the minority.
Are there any questions? It looks like there are no questions.
Thank
it
you.
Is straightforward and simple. Thank you for testifying before, and you can leave. And I'm wondering if anybody else.
But thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair,
and
honorable committee members. All honorable committee members.
If there are no further comments, I will close the public hearing on 2956. And at this time, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2864. We have several representatives, if you can come forward. And the staff person will read us the summary before we get started.
Carol Linthicum, members of the committee. House Bill 2864 defines cultural competency, directs public universities and community colleges to establish processes for recommendation and oversight of cultural competency standards implementation for institutions and employees. The bill specifies that the process must include a broad range of institutional perspectives, give equal weight to administrator, faculty, staff, and student perspectives, require institutions to provide continuing training and development, propose institution-wide goals that seek to improve cultural inclusion, require biennial reports regarding the institution's progress toward achieving goals, recommend mechanisms for assessing how well institutions meet cultural competency standards, and ensure that institutions clearly communicate to new employees commitment to inclusion of cultural competency standards in professional development. The bill requires each public institution of higher education to establish an entity or process that will enable the institution to recommend and provide oversight for implementation of cultural competency standards no later than December 31st, 2019. The bill requires full compliance with requirements no later than December 31st, 2020.
Hello, Vice Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Alonso Leon, and I am the representative from House District 22. As a lifelong advocate for increasing access to education, I am passionate about making sure that students are able to engage in their education in a meaningful way. I am honored to be continuing the hard work of former Representative Joe Gallegos by advancing this bill. House Bill 2864 requires our public universities and community colleges to create cultural competency standards for the institution and their employees. These standards must include containing training opportunities for faculty, staff, and administrators, as well as institution-wide goals on creating an inclusive environment. HB 2864 defines cultural competency to mean the process by which individuals and systems respond respectfully and effectively to people of all cultures, languages, economic statuses, races, ethnic backgrounds, disabilities, religions, genders, gender identifications, sexual orientations, veteran statuses, and other characteristics in a manner that recognizes, affirms, and values the worth of and preserves the dignity of individuals, families, and communities. The bill directs each institution to establish their own process for creating cultural competency standards and goals. This process will include a broad range of perspectives and give equal weight to suggestions from administrators, faculty, staff, and students. This gives students a voice in the process of creating standards, as well as getting them to buy in to the efforts made to create a more inclusive institution. Our goal with this legislation was not to create specific standards or practices for our institutions of higher education, but to create a framework to follow so that each of our individual schools can create a set of standards tailored to the needs of their students, faculty, staff, and administrators. We have worked with the universities and community colleges from early in the drafting process on this legislation to ensure that the creation of these institution-wide standards and goals would not impose or obstruct work that our institutions are currently doing to increase inclusion on their campuses. We have come together to find appropriate language to allow flexibility in the process for creating these standards while addressing the concerns of students that feel that current standards, trainings, and inclusion efforts do not go far enough to create a healthy learning environment. I also want to recognize that many institutions are already taking strides to create a culturally inclusive atmosphere. I myself have worked as a diversity advocacy coordinator at Portland State University in their Global Diversity and Inclusion Office, and have seen firsthand the hard work that is being done to ensure that our institutions of higher education respect and celebrate diversity and inclusion. The purpose of this bill is to supplement the work that is already being done and provide a framework and direction for these efforts. Schools who already have standards can use this as an opportunity to reflect on their progress and make updates where needed. Institutions with inclusion trainings and programs, but no overarching standards and goals, can use this as an opportunity to evaluate the programs to find places to improve. Because I believe that we can and need to improve. I have heard from many students in our public universities and community colleges who have had experiences that make them feel otherwise dismissed, unwelcome, and at times even unsafe in their own schools. Instances range from a faculty member referring to illegals, making their undocumented and DACA students feel fearful, a passing remark from an administrator dismissing the need for gender-neutral restrooms, leaving trans students feeling unwelcomed, or a seemingly casual comment that is rooted in centuries of oppression, leaving our Black and brown students feeling marginalized. I am hopeful that this bill will help our students feel safe, welcomed, and included in our schools. Thank you all so much for your time. If you have any specific questions about the language of the bill, please refer them to Lamar Wise with OSA, who has taken a point on crafting the specifics of this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair, I'm gonna say this right, I hope, Linthicum, and members of the committee. My name is Chris Gorsuch. I am from East Multnomah County, District 49. I'm also a community college teacher, so I come to this particular bill with that kind of a background, 20 years at Mount Hood Community College. Facilitating a culturally sophisticated workforce can help young people become more effective in their careers and more desirable to employers. Improving the etiquette and social skills of both students and faculty in our institutions is a long-standing goal. Informing our interactions in such a way allows our colleges to become more responsive to the needs of our increasingly diverse student bodies while providing a skill set that will serve them well in the work world. A tradition of respect and fair treatment is one of the most basic American values that we must continually strive to attain for the betterment of us all. Colleagues, every semester on college campuses throughout the state, students from different backgrounds and life experiences begin their academic journey here in our state of Oregon. I believe that this legislation is a vital first step towards improving success for those students and ensuring that they are able to develop the ability to relate and to communicate successfully with coworkers, employers, clients, and just members of the community at large. This concludes my testimony, and I am available for any questions you may have. Thank you.
Vice Chair Linthicum. Did I get it right? Yeah. I want to get it right. I'm sorry. It happens to me all the time, too. Diago. Anyway, for the record, my name is Diego Hernandez. I am a state representative for House District 47 in East Portland. And as somebody who just recently graduated from college, I am the youngest legislator, but I did graduate in 2012 from a master's program, and I do have experiences in this issue, actually. I went to the University of Oregon starting in 2005 and stayed there for 5 years. A lot of my work was dedicated towards working in the Multicultural Center with students. I worked with the LGBTQ Center, the Black Student Association, the Latino students, and all the multicultural groups that existed there. And a lot of these issues came up, whether there were swastikas that were drawn on the Women's Center or the LGBTQ Center, whether there were racist incidents that occurred on campus, whether it was the dismal graduation rates and retention rates in our public university systems. And as HEC, the report, Higher Education Coordinating Council reported, our Native and African-American communities are graduating post-secondary education at 50% or lesser. And those dismal rates speak to the reality of what kind of cultural climate exists within our public university systems. When I went on to my master's program at Portland State, I also was an administrator in the Multicultural Center at Portland State. And similarly, the issues in which we worked on were around incidents of hate, were around incidents of where students were dropping out because they didn't feel welcomed. My experience in higher education was one where I was a first generation high school student. Like when I went to high school, I didn't even think I was going to go to college on the other hand, I was one of very few folks of color that graduated in a very diverse school. And once we got into higher education, I almost dropped out twice as a freshman because of the cultural shock. Imagine somebody from the Rockwood area, Gresham area, East Portland area, moving to Eugene and then being the only person of color in most of my classes wasn't the most best experience, to be honest. And because of that experience, I almost dropped out. So this bill really speaks to the importance of making sure that our universities and public universities are accountable to making sure that we have the best climate in the institution so that folks like me and other folks feel welcomed, feel like they have a support system, and feel like the university really has their back so that we can make sure that we have better graduation outcomes and that the disparities in which exist today, particularly among students of color, in graduation rates really is unacceptable, and we must do everything in our power to make sure that we can increase that those outcomes. So I'm just going to leave it there. I hope that you would support this bill. Thank you.
Are there any questions? No questions. I have a couple of items that I am curious about, and with regard to cultural inclusion, it sounds quite frankly like an unfunded mandate. I see the fiscal doesn't show up on here. Several of the small colleges suggested around 10,000. But the scope of this is so enormous, I can't imagine that it, quote, gets absorbed. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. So the idea is that institutions do a self-analysis. And so there wouldn't be any cost in this biennium. It's for the next biennium. And the institutions did say, you know, in order for us to do this work, we were requesting funding for six positions at approximately a quarter time. And so that would be for the next biennium, so they can do their self-analysis and be able to do the work. And then start thinking about what goals do they want to accomplish based on the self-analysis that they do.
And yet that your comment is that there's a phase in time. This is a legislated requirement. What does cultural competency actually look like?
Sure. The good thing about this bill is that not only does the university self-evaluate, but it also creates a work group, if you will, of stakeholders, including faculty and students, to assess. But the bill actually defines what cultural competency means. So under those lenses is in which those work groups that are based upon those institutions, so it's locally controlled in that way, but the parameters are set in ways that still allows for the individuals to have input. But I do want to answer your previous question. This is a question in which I think about as a school board member, particularly in the K through 12 institution, but also in the higher ed institution. Whenever we talk about equity or cultural competency or inclusion, we always think about it as an afterthought and or as something that needs to be done. But I would challenge that kind of thinking and say these are things that our institutions should have been doing already. And there is a reason why we have the outcomes in which we do. And those outcomes speak to not an individual basis, but it speaks to a systemic problem. And that systemic problem is producing the outcomes of lesser than 50% rates of graduation for students of color, particularly for African American Native folks. And so because we have this, that means that there is a legacy within our institutions, our policies, and our systems that we have not changed yet that stem from our history that we need to change. And these university systems should have already had these practices in place and therefore not seen these disparities and not only retention and dropout rates, but also graduation rates.
If I can follow on, thank you, Mr. Chair, for taking over again. If I can follow on with regard to what you just described, it doesn't sound so much like faculty, or is it? Or is it student mitigation or student-initiated problems?
So I think your question sounds like your question is around how is this going to work, right, in each institution. It's a big project.
Well, part of what the representative referred to was graduation mm-hmm. rates, et cetera, and 50% in these impoverished communities or communities of color. And yet you only spend 3 years in middle school, only 4 years in high school. You're not going to impact the graduation rates for thousands of kids on either side of the age segregated cycle you march through. So I don't think it's really a student issue problem, or is it, is my question. And can students mitigate those problems if they exist? And I'm curious about that aspect also.
I'll brief response and then happy.
Yeah,
so part of this work that I'm really excited about is the idea of putting a committee together. And most institutions already have a diversity and inclusion office, and they're already doing some of this work. But what we want to emphasize is that we want to make sure that students are included in this work, and that faculty is included in this work, because obviously their perspectives are very important. And students who are experiencing their college experience will certainly have perspectives that I think need to be valued and considered. And it'll help future students who come to their institutions and addressing some of the challenges that they could potentially experience based on the student input that would be received in these committees. So it's, I think, great work that will occur when we put these committees together and that we have everybody's voices considered.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to your question. There's a really good definition for cultural competency within the bill, mm-hmm. and that is on the first page, small c, line 10 through 15, which is very much like what was described before. The other thing is that this, to my mind, coming at it from a teaching perspective, this is something that is for both instructors and also for students. And it's an idea of both groups, as well as administrators working together to understand the issues in their particular community, and then to try and tailor efforts at improving relationships between some groups that may feel less included and left out. So I see it as both, and I will tell you, as Representative Alonso Leon just said, there are many classes in many schools, myself included, that we already deal with a lot of these issues. This is just an idea of trying to get it standardized so that it's a more consistent approach.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I think about this, I think about something that happened in this committee earlier this session. I think it's always hard to talk about these things because the assumption, it's easy to get defensive and think, well, I didn't mean to do a bad thing, and we've got great professors, we've got great institutions, everybody wants everybody to succeed. But it's more implicit and ingrained. And earlier this session, we actually had a hearing about cultural competency and developing trainings for teachers. And afterwards, the group and some kids came to talk to me about their experience here in our committee and the words that were used to describe testimony and how these students walked away feeling unheard. And I don't believe that the chair had any negative intention. I said some words. I know that I didn't have any negative intention, but that didn't take away from the fact that these young people that came to their capital to advocate for something that was really important left feeling unheard. And what I really appreciated was that these kids had mentors that helped them come back and hold me accountable, mostly so that I could learn and think about how unintentional words might be harmful. So if I was a faculty member, I would want to know that. I wouldn't want something that I did not realize that I was doing was getting in the way of my student learning and progressing. And I think what I'm trying to remember the exact words, but we had different sets of kids, and like one child we told her it was a young Caucasian girl, and we told her she'd done
about eye checkups,
and we told her she did a wonderful job and we should vote on the bill right now, and just how smart and poised she was. And then we had some students of color at the end of the hearing, and we commended them for being brave and articulate. And I think that the thought was that those were compliments, but they carry with them a lot of those words carry a lot of baggage that can imply a lot of other things, and it was very disempowering to those students, even though the words were meant to be empowering. So that's what I look at when I see this bill, whether it's people coming into the building and wanting them to be empowered to advocate in the building or going to an institution of higher education. People should be able to focus on their learning and not have to sort through words and experiences and figure out was that intentional, was that not intentional, or deal with what that brings up because of prior experiences. So I'm really grateful to you for bringing forward the bill.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, absolutely. To my mind, that's exactly what this is about, is creating dialogue, because sometimes we do see things and say things that we don't think about it and don't think of it because it's outside of our own cultural context. And this is a way to try and get to some of that and make it so that people don't then go, oh, I know what you meant, and it was not a good thing. So I think it's very important in that respect.
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser, just to speak to it, the bill sets up a very diverse set of stakeholders that not only thinks and about the culture and the day-to-day conversation aspect of it, but also the institutional, whether it's policy, whether it's boards that make decision-making, and have a much broader analysis, and which goes from individual but also into the macro and institutional components of what creates an environment and what creates those outcomes, and how can we best build an institution that really works for everybody and so that everybody is graduating.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Looking at the definition of cultural competency, and this is supposed to be inclusive, I'm just wondering why cultural competency means an understanding of how institutions and individuals can respond respectfully and effectively to all people. I mean, you know, because that's really what we're after, right? Rather than identifying subgroups, make it totally inclusive. The way I look at it, I think maybe that is a more inclusive definition.
Certainly something to consider.
However, I think that it's also important to acknowledge who all is the people. I think that's also, and that's why we identified everybody else in here. So just to reiterate what the definition is the process by which individuals and systems respond respectfully and effectively to people of all cultures, languages, economic statuses, races, ethnic backgrounds, disabilities, religions, gender identification, sexual orientations, veteran statuses, and other characteristics in a manner that recognizes, affirms, and values the worth of and preserves the dignity of individuals, families, and communities.
If I could, I fully understand that, but I'm not sure that identifying subgroups when it's supposed to be inclusive is necessarily helpful. The end of that I agree with as well, but I'm just saying this is, if it's inclusive, maybe it should actually say it without creating subgroups, because my fear is we don't want subgroups, we want everybody together, and so identifying subgroups is almost counterproductive in a way.
Chair Roblin, Senator Cruz, that's a good point to point out. I think, nonetheless, when we look at data and we see the disparities and or incidents in which occur, and we break that out down by demographics, we can see that there is disparities by those subgroups. And in order for us to understand what is creating that, that those disparities and those outcomes and those incidents, we need to understand that data by making sure that we identify, on the one hand, who those subgroups are. On the other hand, these are experiences of people, whether they're coming from an underrepresented or marginalized identity. Their identity to them is important to them, so they also want that to be something that is acknowledged, whether that is the lived experience in which they have brought because of who they are and the incidents in which they have lived through, whether that is incidents of racism or sexism or homophobia, et cetera, and or discrimination and or outright exclusion. Those experiences are important. In order for us to understand those experiences, we have to be able to acknowledge the identity of these groups on the one hand, but on the other hand, we also have to understand how the data is breaking down so that we can respond appropriately and we can come up and mitigate the problem based on that data.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I understand that, and I think everybody's aware of that. I'm just looking at what is actually in statute rather than what will actually the process. Mm-hmm. That's my thing. I mean, you understand, I mean, what we put in statute is one thing. What's actually going to take place is going to be inclusive because it says inclusive. I just have concerns when we're calling out subgroups, you know, because if you make it general, you include everybody. If you start breaking it down by the fact that those who are not specifically spelled out are excluded.
No, I hear what you're saying, and that's something. So, from a different perspective, kind of coming out of the disability community as a disability advocate, where a huge goal that we have is inclusion and not being segregated and not being separate. But one of the reasons that I always advocate for disability to be called out, and disability advocates do, is too often, like, the word "all" has not actually meant all. It hasn't actually meant everyone, and until we collectively have an understanding that all needs all, historically underserved and underrepresented groups, in my opinion, need to be named so that we're so that we're able to elevate that and recognize it. And that's part of the root of the problem, is if we subconsciously don't believe that or don't understand that all means all, if we don't lay it out, not everybody is included or feels included.
Thank you. I guess
want to say one more thing?
Well, just to follow on to this conversation, great points. I think that it becomes a little divisive to name all these. There are nearly 200 countries in the world in terms of culture. Mm-hmm. Within those countries, there's dialects and subcultures and maybe 5,000 or 6,000 total cultures on the planet. And how anyone may take something that we say or don't say when they're at a post-secondary university, we'll really never know. We'll not be able to incorporate all of those things. And I think the point that the senator made with regard to respond respectfully and effectively to all people in a manner that recognizes, affirms, and values the worth, preserves dignity of individuals, families, and communities. Bingo, that's the bottom line that you're striving for. Now, how that gets implemented across the college and university landscape is a different story, and the items that they choose to call out would be appropriate or not based on statistics and gathering of information. But one of the items that I distinctly see missing here is age. The elderly are not respected in this little, list. The young are, if you have a 12-year-old prodigy going to the university, he's not respected according to this list from a cultural perspective, from his age group, from his whatever, from whatever. So all of a sudden we've missed a bucket, and then we'll come back and forth. And I think the senator's words were appropriate. All means all. Let's make it mean all to the best we can. And I heard your comments were well spoken too. So it's both sides of the fence.
And I guess what I would say to this argument is that I think that having a list is important, not that it is the list, but that as a human being, you're in a situation, if you realize there's a really big list and you don't have it with you, then you're more likely to say that the person sitting across from me may be part of the list, maybe somebody we left off the list, but I have the same responsibility to that person to listen to them clearly, to try to figure out where they're coming from, and to make them feel valued in the conversation. Yeah. And that's kind of what it's saying. And I think if we don't have a list, people lump groups together that shouldn't be lumped together, and that creates another kind of a problem. I know that my very beginning experience as a new teacher when I was doing student teaching in my hometown taught me one of the biggest learning examples I've ever had, because I ended up with some Native kids, and I had a lot of friends who were Native kids, but I didn't understand at all. And now as a teacher, the brightest math kid in my class was not doing well, and I could not figure it out, and I had a chance. I knew their tribal leader, and so he'd worked at the mill with him, and I went and talked to him, and I said, why is this? He fails every one of my tests, and I know he knows all the stuff. He knows it better than anybody else in the class. And he said, well, you have different values than we do. He's going to be a leader in our tribe, so he's not looking to go someplace else and to be something else. He's planning on staying right here in little old Port Angeles, Washington. And tribes are very place-based, and your education system is based on giving everybody the opportunity to go any place they want in the world. And he knows that he's not going anyplace in the other world. He doesn't want to go. He has a responsibility to his people to stay there. And so if you don't value that, if your teaching doesn't value the fact that he needs this, he knows how to do the math. You don't have to tell him. He already knows how he can do it. And he would rather put a test out there in front of all the kids to see that shows he failed, because there's three other kids from his tribe there who know that he's smarter than them, and they did better than him. That makes him feel better than getting an A on the test. Mm-hmm. It was really eye-opening to me to start having a conversation with him about, you can help me teach the other kids. I want you to do that rather than take the test. You can do some other things. Because I knew he was getting the material. You don't have to treat everybody the same to get similar results. And you don't have to put your value into what's valuable for that person. And it was, I've hopefully led with that my whole life, and recognizing that just because I think this is a really good thing to go to college doesn't mean it's a really good thing to go to college. Right. And so I like the list just because it reminds me that there's a lot of different people out there, and I should be thinking of every person I meet as I do with every tribe in Oregon. If you've met one, you've met one, and you need to recognize and listen to people in ways that are different. So I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you having the bill. We have a lot of people to get to, so...
Can I add one last comment?
Yes,
just to close
one last
it out.
We always let freshmen do one last comment.
Chair Rowland. just to speak on that, I think the reason why such a policy has come in front of you is because of our history of exclusion when we've had language of all. Some of us may know the history of higher education and public institutions and who's been excluded and who's been included and what kind of culture was created in public and particularly higher education. So as we continue to see the diversification of our population and more folks actually going on to higher education from these marginalized and underrepresented communities, we're starting to see the outcomes, and those we've always seen the outcomes, but those outcomes are things that we're reacting to. And I've had this conversation for over 18 years of how do we make institutions more equitable, particularly in K through 12, but also in higher ed, because the statistics in which exist today existed when we segregated our public institutions. So there's still some problems that come from our historical practices. And that's why we have to take measures in which account for these realities that exist within our communities, whether that be high rates of sexual assault on our college campuses, whether that be high rates of racism and incidents of racism or exclusion or discrimination in our higher education institutions or sexism. You know, we all know that women weren't allowed to attend certain institutions until a certain time, and including other populations. So it's important to understand that history and how that still that still exists to this day, and these outcomes speak to that historical narrative. And I'll just end it with that.
Okay. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day. So, Joel Fisher, Mariana, why can I not get that name? Paradin? And I know that person. And Erna Gillis.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of the Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. We're a statewide membership organization with over, I believe it is 1,700 employers. We employ over 250,000 people across Oregon from employers that are both large and small. Maybe an unlikely candidate up here to be talking about this, but education is a very large focus for our associations. It's incredibly important to the health and vitality of the state. One of the biggest and most pressing issues facing our education system is chronic absenteeism. And in 2016, the Oregon Department of Education published a report showing that one of chronic absenteeism often is a function of culturally responsive education practices in our schools. We believe that this bill can go a long way in helping resolve that issue, and we're here to lend our support. Thank you for your time.
Hello, Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Mariana Sofia Paredones, and I'm a student at Lane Community College. I'm also part of the Oregon Student Association and serve as one of the co-chairs for the Oregon Students of Color Coalition Board. And I was also appointed by the governor to sit on the Higher Education Coordinating Commission as a community college representative. Additionally, I can serve some expertise on this bill, as I was one of the students who participated in the House Bill 3308 Cultural Competency Work Group, which passed back in 2015 in the last long legislative session. We worked for a year-ish on this work group with different school administrators, faculty, staff, students, and members of the HEC, and we worked very hard and diligently to come up with some recommendations on the importance of cultural competency and how to implement that on our college campuses. So I strongly believe that this is the right direction towards addressing some of these quintessential issues on our campuses, a safety and a strive for true equity, and how that impacts our ability to be successful and in some cases survive. I want to address that one of the members mentioned that age wasn't listed on the bill, but it actually is encompassed when we talk about non-traditional students. So that 12-year-old or a student that's over 30, 40 years old, those are students that are considered non-traditional, especially when we talk about our campuses. It is evident in our state with this past year that several campus actions led by students have sparked conversations on social tensions and how these students are looking to our legislators to find solutions. I've been a student at LCC for almost 3 years, and I came here hoping to get my start in the post-secondary education career. I am a political science major with a focus on ethnic studies, and I almost dropped out after I took one history class. I had a very interesting history teacher who liked to use some very explicit language, very derogatory language, and showed videos in our classes of Native tribes having their hearts taken out by colonizers. It was historically inaccurate, but he showed it regardless of the content. And although I met with the department chair of the social science department, I was told that my faculty has the ability to say whatever he wants and do as he wants because that's the culture that's set up on our campus. Even though we passed a cultural competency policy at LCC, it's far from being implemented, and we need the state to help students and the faculty on our campus champion this on our campuses. This is something that a lot of students and leaders have been working on for a while, and I feel like this is going to set a strong precedent that all stakeholders on campus can bring forward safety and inclusion on our campus. Because if I had had my history teacher like willing to stop using the N-word or willing to stop calling Natives Redskins and Mexicans like Beaners as a joke, and like these are well-intended jokes, but they still leave an impact on you, and I stopped going to class after week 3 and ended up failing the class. I'm a bright student, but that really wrecked my spirit, and I feel like there are other students who've had encounters like this on campus with faculty members unwilling and really not caring about listening to us and what affects us. And I feel like you'll hear more about that from student testimonies. But if you have any questions on the bill, I can answer a lot of questions. And I was kind of eager back there. I was like, I can answer these. So thank you for listening to my testimony. And I hope you consider this as you're voting on the issue. But the HEC also posted the recommendations. It's a packet on one of the diversity tabs on the website that you can all read more about cultural competency and the studies we did on our different college campuses. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erna Gellis. I'm a professor emerita of public administration and nonprofit management at Portland State University, where I've taught for almost 20 years in the School of Government. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Oregon State Conference of the American Association of University Professors. We are a statewide association, relatively new, but we represent over 3,400 members at 5 public institutions at this point, as well as some privates. I want to thank you for your service in this committee and in this institution, and for the opportunity to communicate with you on this important issue. On behalf of the members of AAUP, the professors in Oregon, our collective bargaining faculty chapters at University of Oregon and Portland State in particular, and our faculty across Oregon, I'm here to ask that you please support House Bill 2864A. As faculty members, we teach a wide variety of students and work every day to make our classrooms and institutions welcoming places for those from every background. We understand the structural inequities and challenges that many of our students face. This bill commits our universities as institutions to include every stakeholder group on our multiple campuses in conversations about how to deepen this work, and then sets goals and a reporting process. The stakeholders include students and faculty and administrators and staff. Staff hasn't really been mentioned here, but they are gatekeepers and really, really critical in this regard. In deciding to support the bill actively, we engaged in many extensive conversations about the importance of this work and how to go about ensuring that it gets done. The final version of this bill strikes a good balance that furthers inclusion while preserving academic freedom and the crucial role of faculty in shared governance. I'd like to add something that is not in my written testimony that occurred to me when I was listening before. 4 years ago, I led my units, the public administration programs, reaccreditation with a network of schools of public affairs and administration, which is now an international body. But bottom line is it accredits MPA, Master of Public Administration, and Master of Public Policy programs. Mostly across the country, but some internationally. One of the five universal competencies that they identified with a lot of feedback from faculty and institutions across the country was a respect for diversity, which we now have sort of contained within the cultural competency, equity, and inclusion conversations. To gain accreditation, to retain accreditation, we need to be doing this work. And so our institution has been paying a great deal of attention to it. But broadening the work that we do to include even more students and even more staff and faculty, some of whom, when they have a PhD, think they know it all. And so creating an environment that respects that we are all growing and constantly educating ourselves is a piece of this and absolutely essential. So as Oregon faculty, we're committed to all our students and to the goal of moving the work of justice forward. This bill is part of an important process and it has our strong support. So I, too, will answer any questions you
may
have.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes. Senator.
Just a real quick one. Since you're here as a prof.
Who doesn't know everything.
you mentioned maintaining academic freedom. Mm-hmm. And also some diverse form of governance, student governance or whatnot. How do you marry that with the rights of conscience for an individual?
That's a great question. We could probably spend hours talking about it. But I think a piece of what conscience is about is perspective and exposure, because conscience is an ongoing and developing process. And so making sure that people have opportunities for these conversations so that they can learn from some of the mistakes that they may have made unbeknownst to them is a part of that. It's funny because when we're talking about this, I was the age piece. Ageism is actually a term that is used in the field. And a few years ago, a newer colleague of mine who's about to become a tenured faculty member as I retire, she's moving up. She got irritated when I would refer to her very casually as kid. Hey kid, how are you doing? And finally was able to say it to me to counter me. But shortly thereafter, she also called me to task for something that I hadn't ever considered, and that was apparently some students were concerned that I was using the term millennials as a sort of a broad statement describing a group of people born between certain years. And that in itself was offensive to some people. And they felt more comfortable coming to her than they did to me, which had me concerned, but it also made me stop to think about sort of this process of the age piece is not just our non-traditional students, but it's relationships of faculty, the elders in the room, who stand at a podium and lecture and seem to have truth compared to those others in the room. And I think that's incredibly important. And for me, coming into this field, because I work with adults, people who are oftentimes in their late 20s, 30s, 40s, I have a great deal to learn from them. If I'm open to it, then I learn more. But you have to create the right kind of environment so that those conversations happen. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Okay. Thank you for the three of you. Next, we have Quentin Rose, Justin Bennett, and Ashley Kim. And thank you all for being here.
Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and Vice Chairman Lithicum and members of the committee. I am Quentin Rose. I'm a first-year student at Lynn Benton Community College. I am also incoming Legislative Affairs Director, and I'm also in affiliation with the Oregon Student Association. I am here today in support of House Bill 2864. I support this bill because as a student of color, cultural competency impacts my education. Not only will this bill help to give our instructors and professors the tools to make sure that students alike feel safe in all classroom settings. I may be a first-year college student, but even in my experiences in K through 12 schools, I noticed that a lot of microaggressions in several classes of mine. For example, my senior year in my history class, you were talking about Black History Month, and she allowed students to do a skit on the KKK and provided them with clothing that represented members of the KKK. And there was a few other students of color in that classroom that were offended. And when I spoke up about it, she told me that it wasn't a big deal and I shouldn't be upset about it. So I dropped her class. And nothing happened to her, but I failed the class because of it. And I never want to see this happen again, especially on the college level where I'm trying to be successful. And if it can happen in a high school, it can definitely happen in a college. There's been a lot of talk that professors do not find passing a bill as necessary, and that cultural competency is already being practiced. This may be the case in some institutions, but not at all. Professors are still human and their own individual person. And without passing a bill which requires adequate training, who's to say any difference will be made? I ask you, members of the committee, how important is the education of future leaders? Because when a student is made to feel like they are unsafe or they become uncomfortable in a school, they won't want to be there, and therefore they won't be able to attain the necessary education to succeed and contribute to society. I urge you to support this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hello, Senate Education Committee. Thank you, Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Lintikam, for allowing me to testify here today. My name is Justin Bennett. I'm an associated student of Oregon State University Senator, as well as a member of the Oregon Student Association. At one point in my life, cultural competency had been as vague and amorphous a term as space is large. That is to say, that I had no understanding of what cultural competency meant, let alone what it encompassed. And I bring up this point to demonstrate a shift that anyone can undergo, an educational understanding of cultural competency in the classroom, a recognition of microaggressions and implicit biases. I grew up in a pretty small town of about 10,000 people, and we were white. And when I think back to my time in high school, I can vaguely conjure up the image of about 3 students of color in our entire high school. The words cultural competence carried about as much weight as a glass of water. But upon my attendance to Oregon State University, I was able to not just realize that the world is so much more diverse and varied than I thought, but I was also able to educate myself on the issues affecting students. I'm testifying on behalf of all the students that were unable to testify today, but those that most need a voice. My friends and colleagues and coworkers, all of those affected by a lack of cultural competence. I think of my friends who don't identify within the gender binary, and I cringe when my professor says, "Let's split into boys and girls, please," and then, when my friend stands up to say, "I don't identify with either of those," the teacher, confused, narrows her brow and says, "Oh, I'm sorry, what are you?" I cringe to think about the time my coworker, who's a person of color, was asked to translate for a Spanish-speaking student because, "You look like you speak Spanish, right?" We can prevent moments like these with education. These things seem so small sometimes, and it's easy to argue that. It's also easy not to say these things and to overcome biases by furthering our education. I think it's important to note that I don't face these microaggressions and biases on a regular basis, but I hope that my presence as an individual who continues to see these ongoing problems on our campuses affecting others urges strong legislative action. This education begins with holding our instructors and institutions accountable. I have this idea that maybe cultural competence won't be such a foreign concept in my hometown after all, and that is why I urge you to support HB 2864 and continue to better our understanding of cultural competency. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Hello, Chairman Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Ashley Kim. I'm currently a freshman at Lane Community College. I immigrated to America from South Korea during my freshman year of high school. Since my English is not my first language, standing here in front of you and testifying makes me really nervous. I fear that I will not be able to properly word my own experience as a person of color at LCC, but I hope that you will listen to my experience very seriously. During my second term at LCC, I took a required writing class. I was not yet confident in my writing skills and was a little bit afraid to participate in the college-level class discussion. I experienced multiple microaggressions and unfair treatment from my instructor. For example, my class had 11 students, and 4 of those students identified as Asian, including me. When we had class discussion or group assignments, my instructor would always group us together. This made me feel like she had no lower expectations on us, and no matter how hard I tried, it still felt like there was a wall that I couldn't climb in order to become one of her favorite students. On a daily basis, I experienced offensive and inappropriate questions like, "Where are you from? Are you Chinese? Or are you Japanese?" And eventually some comments on how well I speak English. Usually all of these happens before they even ask for my name. When I first moved here during my freshman year of high school, probably 90% of students were white. As I started making white friends and becoming a part of white society, I felt I began losing my own identity. I felt like if I didn't act a certain way, the society wouldn't accept me. I couldn't dress up the way I want. I couldn't use my own language when I'm not around people who look like me. I had to give up my own identity to build a new one because I knew people wouldn't accept me as who I am. And guess what? I still have to act that way. I believe that cultural competency standards will help prevent students from feeling like they have to assimilate and forget who they are as individuals. By creating cultural competency standards, educators can be instructed on how to be more supportive of students with diverse backgrounds and will truly help other students like me. They'll feel protected and safe, which will lead them to create more inclusive and positive learning environments. Obtaining a higher education is something I believe is extremely important. If we do not have instructors that will make all students feel accepted, then we will not be able to further our understanding of other cultures, identities, and beliefs. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. And you did a very nice job of
Oh, thank you. It's my first testimony. I'm so nervous.
You did a great job.
Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our last person is Imane Dorsey. I hope it's that similarly correct. You can correct it later. So. You get to be all by yourself.
Unless
there's somebody else that needed to get up here. Okay. I guess it's all yours.
Okay. Hello, Chair Roblin and committee members. My name is Imane Dorsey, and I'm a first-year student at the University of Oregon. I'm here to ask you for your support for Cultural Competency Bill, HB 2864. So a large part of my identity is my cultural background. I'm half Black and half Filipino. I moved to Oregon 5 years ago from Sacramento, California, in 2012, and my main concern when I first moved here was a lack of diversity. I remember reading the demographics of the high school I was to attend, and it was something like 66% white, 8% Black, 2% of two or more races, and I was really shocked. But I wasn't too worried because I had no prior experience of ever sticking out. But it wasn't uncommon that I was the only Black girl, and only Black girl or one of two Black people in my classes. I love my high school, and it was somewhat diverse compared to other schools in Beaverton, but if you can even call it that, the fact that my race was so noticeable for myself and for others is a problem. Feeling uncomfortable when we got to the slavery unit of AP US History because my peers thought it would be okay to stare at me when they started talking about slavery and ask me questions as if I was the spokesperson for my ancestors. Reading Fences by August Wilson in my AP Literature class and listening to my white peers alter their voices and sort of like adopt some sort of morphing of their like an accent to sound black, as they said, and my teacher doing nothing about it. I never saw teachers or administrators fully address students who made insensitive or ignorant comments or continue to perpetuate stereotypes. Even at a university where I expected the community to be more inclusive and informed and sensitive to the cultural experiences of others, this happens way too often. I appreciate the language used to make the university more welcoming and inclusive, but it's not enough. There needs to be a more aggressive and blatant attempt to make cultural competency fundamental. Respect for those unlike you, especially for oppressed folk who undoubtedly have it harder, is not something to be debated over. Don't get me wrong, I know most people mean no harm, but their lack of proper knowledge is what is preventing change. I can't count the number of times I ended class frustrated and bothered because I can't believe some of the things that came out of the mouths of my peers. And I'm just yearning for someone to understand the nature of my experience and simply respect the complexities. I'm certain that if instructors and faculty maintain cultural relevancy, they could be more effective teachers and allies and serve students of every background on campus to influence greater retention of folks from underrepresented communities and give us an improved experience in higher education. It's also important to note that cultural competency training would educate others so we don't have to unless we want to. It's exhausting to have to teach others and offer my perspective because, one, it's emotional labor to teach others something I feel should already be known. And not everyone has the same experience, and I can't speak for everyone. This method would solve that, I believe. So I'm asking you to please support this bill and take a step in the right direction and make respect for all cultures and all underrepresented groups mandatory. Informing now will hopefully inform generations come and shift the status quo. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Okay.
You represent yourself really well. That's all of the testimony for our cultural competency bill, and I anticipate it will show up quickly on a work session. But we like to let things lie for a little while in this committee until we get into the deadline time. But so we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2864, and we'll put it on the agenda coming up. We're going to do a couple of our work sessions right now, just because some of my committee has to leave in a few minutes, so and they go fairly quickly. So House Bill 2219 has an amendment, and I'm going to invite two people up to just explain that amendment. We are not going to take action because we don't have all the paperwork on those, but I'll check with the committee about whether we want to do the amendment or not. But I did assure the sponsor of the base bill that his bill is going to go along, whether or not has an amendment to it. So a short explanation of the amendment so that we can be ready for next meeting.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm here representing the Civics Education Initiative. The -A3 amendment is a option amendment, basically, that would allow for school districts that would opt in to the base bill, the civic education opportunity that the base bill contemplates, that they could also opt in to offering as a way to prove proficiency in civics, the opportunity to take the United States citizenship test, basically to prove proficiency. This is a follow-on to the conversation we had earlier with regarding Senator Riley's bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, it's relatively simple. It's an opt-in provision, just like the base bill is.
So question, in the previous one, it had other requirements with it, like graduation and so on. This one is, that's not there at all. It's taking the 100 base questions.
Yep.
And giving an opportunity for people to meet some of their civics requirements to take that exam.
Basically, it would allow for school districts that took advantage of the base bill to say, hey, if we could potentially use the United States citizenship test as a way for our students to prove proficiency.
Okay. Any questions?
No mandate.
No mandate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So we'll carry House Bill 2219 over to our next meeting, and then time we should have all of the bill paperwork ready. So we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2258. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2258 allows the Oregon Department of Education to give funding to statewide nonprofit organizations promoting leadership in career and technical education that relates to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education and activities. The bill expands the scope of entities from school districts, education service districts, public schools, public charter schools, community colleges, and public universities to include statewide nonprofit organizations in any combination in order to qualify for departmental funding.
So, Senator Lithicum, are you okay with this bill?
Let's see, Chair Roblin, I will move House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? It's allowing us to pass money through to organizations that are providing these things. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the bill? Seeing none, it passes. And we need a carrier. Anybody wish to carry it? If not, okay, we'll let Sarah carry it. Thank you. We'll close the work session on 2258. We're going to open a work session on 3313, and we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3313 allows public charter schools to give priority admissions to students who reside within the service boundaries of a non-chartered public school that closed not more than 2 years before the charter school began to operate. The Dash 4 Amendment allows public charter schools to give priority admission to students if the following conditions are met. The school district that closed the non-chartered public school is the sponsor of the public charter school. The public charter school is physically located within the attendance boundaries of the closed school, and the school district board approved the public charter school giving priority to students of the closed school.
So, Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move the Dash 4 Amendment dated 5-1 of 17 to House Bill 3313.
Senator Lithicum moves the Dash 4 Amendment, dated 5-1-17, to House Bill 3313. Any discussion? Any opposition? Amendment is adopted. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 3313 as amended with the Dash 4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 3313 as amended with the Dash 4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So passed. I will ask Senator Beyer. He is one of the people who helped do this bill to carry that bill, and otherwise I will carry it. So one or the other. And we'll close our work session on 3313, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2312.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2312 updates terms and references associated with the implementation of the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. It changes the name of the State Workforce Investment Board to the State Workforce Development Board, directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to perform functions previously performed by the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2312 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 2312 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So passed. Anybody wish to carry this bill? If not, I will carry the bill. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2312, and we will open very good. I'm going to open a work session on House
Bill.
Public hearing, thank you. It's nice to have these people that take care of me. House Bill 3340, we're going to open that work session. We'll invite our two guests to come up, and we'll have a short explanation of the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3340 requires the Oregon Department of Education to collaborate with the Bureau of Labor and Industries to prepare materials in written or electronic form regarding apprenticeship opportunities. The bill requires ODE to provide materials on apprenticeship programs to public high schools and requires distribution of the materials to both students and parents or guardians when high schools provide information related to higher education opportunities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues. House Bill 3340
passed.
Oh, sorry.
He helped me too, so it's okay.
My name is Dallas Hurd. I'm the representative of House District 2, primarily right down the center of Douglas County and parts of Jackson and Josephine County. I'm here speaking in favor of House Bill 3340, which passed the House unanimously. It's a simple bill. It's promoting the skilled trades apprenticeships within the high schools of Oregon. When I reflect on my community, it has a tremendous amount of hardworking, great blue-collar folks in it that unfortunately have not always shown to want to finish high school. I'll admit it, I didn't want to finish high school. So I think it's important that Oregon's high school students, especially in the rural communities, understand the lucrative job opportunities that are awaiting for them in the skilled trade industry. Many of these trades, like pipe fitters, electricians, mm-hmm. what have you, provide fully funded higher education for their apprentices. So I don't want to keep you here too long, but essentially anytime an Oregon high school is going to provide information on college opportunities and job career opportunities, we want to have those students, their guardians, their parents, what have you, have that information put in front of them so that they are aware of what's out there. And hopefully that will keep several of these young individuals who have been showing to be dropping out to actually stay engaged all the way through high school, because I think it's quite clear it'll be a much easier process for them to transfer into the trade skills and go on to a lucrative job opportunity. So with that, I will yield to my colleague.
Thank you. Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Linthicum. It is my pleasure to speak in support of HB 3340. My name is Chris Gorsuch, and I am the representative from District 49, East Multnomah County. My fine colleague here has covered a lot of it, so let me just say that in my particular district, trade jobs often sit open and just waiting for the people with the right qualifications to come along. Having the opportunity to expand awareness... Bless you.
Thank you.
Having the opportunity to expand the awareness of these sorts of jobs is just another way we can ensure young people who are seriously interested in high-wage careers let them know about these opportunities, which do not necessarily require long stints in community or a regular college. So 3340, it ensures that during career days and college prep events, the guidance counselors will have information about BOLI certified local apprenticeships. It helps to promote filling the many jobs that are being created as the previous generation of skilled crafts women and men retire. And it provides a real connection for young people that might not otherwise be aware that excellent career opportunities are available in the skilled trades. So that concludes my testimony, and I'm here for any questions.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, to myself, when I look at what the skilled trades are in those industries, I think a lot of times it is something that interests a lot of, again, I'm going to hit back to a lot of the young people that are dropping out of school. A lot of times they do not enjoy the scholastic environment. It's just a difficult thing for them. They are more geared towards operating equipment, building buildings, making stuff. And let's face it, I mean, we need people like that. And so, again, I think it really it's something that's really focused on what interests them. And, again, we need them to stay engaged all the way through their high school career and then move on to something great.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes. Senator.
How's the family doing?
They're doing good. Yep, I got the senator's referring to my wife and I, Hannah, just had a new baby boy named Ezra, so 2.5 weeks old now, put on about 2 pounds, so the credit definitely goes to mom on that.
And
hopefully
questions?
My boys will actually go pursue a better job than this from an income standpoint.
I will say that this is a bill that I appreciate. I think we've done it in a lot of our schools. We need to do more, and we need to make it easier for them to know how to do it. So I come from a vocational family. My dad was the apprenticeship trainer in our local community. And so carpentry was always something, but my uncle was an electrician. All of my family were in one of these trades that we're talking about, and they all went through apprenticeship programs. I appreciate that we as a legislator took action to make apprenticeship. When you finish apprenticeship, you've met that requirement, like a community college, so with our 40-40-20. Yep. And I agree with you, getting kids involved. I used to teach a technical math class because they didn't really like math, and then you'd show them the stuff you have to do to become an electrician or to be a sheet metal worker or whatever, and all of a sudden they said, oh, that's math.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's math. That's right.
As a contractor, I use it every single day, every day.
So it's always important. So thank you for bringing the bill. Any further questions for the group? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here. There's no one else signed
Mr. Chair?
Up. Yes.
Senator Cruz, yeah. Just remember that Representative Wisnett does not speak for the rest of us, because I know he was kind of mean to you earlier.
I'm sure. Well,
just for the record, Gene and I have been friends for a very long time, so it's okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we were looking for an apprenticeship program in farming, but we don't have one.
Oh.
So we were concerned. I know Cruz is concerned about this, so you guys might want to have a conversation.
There we go.
Make him feel better.
There we go. Thank you.
So with that, we're going to close our public hearing, unless there was people out there that really wanted to talk about the committee. Okay, there were. Close our public hearing on, let's see, that would be,
3340.
Thank you, 3340. We're going to open a public hearing. Oh, we've got lots of special guests here today. You want? Okay, we'll go with, there's a lot of people with this one. So what we're going to do right now, just so you know, we're going to open House Bill 2666 to take this testimony. Then we're going to go back and open House Bill 2311 to take that testimony, and with only one person, we'll come back
okay. And
get everybody.
I'll try
so
to
we're going
to
open our public hearing on 2666. Thank you. My dyslexia comes through in weird ways sometimes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is southeast and a little sliver of northeast Portland. And I'm here to speak with you about House Bill 2666A, which is a bill that extends to community college students and their student governments the ability to determine the amount of the incidental or student fee for student activities and have that fee collected as developed by the students themselves at community college, as is currently permitted for students who attend four-year public universities. I got my start in politics when I was in college. My sophomore year, I was the student senator for my dorm at Miami University, Peabody Hall, located in Oxford, Ohio. And I can't resist sharing this, but United States House of Representative Speaker Paul Ryan and I were classmates. There are a lot of others among us that got their start with student government in some form as well. Representative Gomberg, Representative Clem, Representative Williamson, Representative Julie Parrish, Representative Hernandez, Representative Evans, Representative Bentz, Senator Boquist, and our state treasurer, and I think Speaker Kotek was involved in graduate student government. There's probably others that I'm leaving out, I just don't know or remember. Anyhow, one of the jobs of the Student Senate was to allocate money for campus activities to fund clubs, organizations, athletics, things that would enrich campus life for students. And we funded groups and clubs that did cultural things, that took students camping or did service projects, and as well as sports and intramural athletics. I gotta say, sometimes the decisions about what to fund and how much funding was needed were debated and could get quite heated. It was an early lesson, I think, in politics and civic life that stuck with me. The four-year public universities in our state have a very robust student fee process, both for setting the fee and for allocating it. Frankly, it was more sophisticated than the one that I experienced in Ohio when I was a student. House Bill 2666A allows the students and their student governments at community colleges to allocate the proceeds of their student fee to student activities and do it just as done at the four-year universities. For those of you that don't know or maybe don't remember, student-initiated or incidental fees are non-academic fees paid by all students taking on-campus courses at a post-secondary institution or university. In 2013, this Legislative Assembly passed House Bill 3120, which established a process for four-year public university boards to collect student incidental fees upon request of the recognized student government. However, that bill left out the community colleges, and this bill is attempting to extend that to them. I'll just point out that the House got confused about a few things when we debated this bill. The bill does not raise tuition, as that is still reserved for the community college board and the voters to decide. It doesn't even raise the student fee, as quite often the amount of the fee fluctuates based on the needs and priority of the students and their elected student government. The bill also has nothing to do with student unions. A few of my colleagues attempted to confuse the student union, a building, with a labor union, and that is an entirely different thing. In short, I see no reason why students at community colleges shouldn't have the same opportunity for some self-governance that is enjoyed by the four-year universities. And I'd ask you to support this bill, and I'll let you know that I worked it out with the community college
Association, and I believe that they are supportive of the bill as well, and I hope that you'll give it consideration.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Nuss? I would just say I got my start at community college education too. I lost my first election. It was really heartbreaking for me, but it did. My wife, future wife at the time, she wasn't. She did win. It really irritated me.
Uh-huh.
Not against me, against somebody else. It was really frustrating. But I had decided I was coming back. So.
Yep. Right on.
So with that, we're going to leave it open, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2311, and we'll have our illustrious former representative and current director of HEC come on up and give us an explanation of this bill.
Thank you. I'm Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. House Bill 2311 is about 40-40-20, and I think when we're talking about something as familiar now to us, to policymakers, to you, as 40-40-20, a certain kind of weariness may set in, and given the aspirational nature of the goal and the fact we're a long way from it, I think that weariness can even turn to cynicism. So at the outset, I want to just try to answer the question very briefly of why this even matters. And I don't think I can give a broad answer, and others may be better qualified to do so. But I can tell you why it matters to the HEC, to my commission. And it is because this goal continues to be the foundation of our work on budget recommendations to the governor and to the legislature, on funding allocations that we administer, on the policy that we review and propose and within our authorities adopt, the data and reporting that we do. We orient that all to this goal that is so fundamental in for us and resides in Oregon statute. So now to the bill. It's pretty simple, and I won't spend very long going over it. The bill simply clarifies that 40-40-20, if this were to pass, would apply in those terms to the rising adult population, the high school class of 2025 and beyond, students who are coming up through the Oregon K-12 system, and it would be about their higher educational outcomes within a certain reasonable period of time from completing high school. At the same time, it would say about all Oregon adults that we should have ambitious and aspirational goals for them when it comes to higher education, but not necessarily 40-40-20. That if we're talking about Oregonians in their 40s, 50s, 60s, the goals should be refined in conjunction with the Workforce Investment Board and community colleges and other stakeholders. It should be refined to be appropriate for that population and appropriate in terms of actual and potential labor market opportunities. So the reason for bringing the bill is that today the goal, as written in statute, applies to the entire Oregon population. There are no parameters on it. It doesn't say it's 40-40-20 specifically about rising young adults. It says it's for all Oregonians. And taken literally, that would imply sort of massive investments in adult education, even education for your high school equivalency education for senior citizens who hadn't graduated high school. So this is really, in a sense, a fairly technical amendment to bring some clarity to the 40-40-20 goal to ensure that we retain ambitious goals for adult Oregonians as well as young Oregonians rising through our K-12 system in order to make it more sort of practical and useful for at least our commission in its attempt to develop budget and policy and other recommendations for helping to meet it. Mr. Chair, I will note that in addition to being sort of a key part of the HEC's existing strategic plan, this change, it is also the case that this change would not on its own improve Oregon's data towards 40-40-20. We were asked this question in the House, well, if you make this change, do we all of a sudden look like we're doing really well? The answer is actually no. We do better expressed as the entire adult population. We benefit from all the in-migration and folks to Oregon with degrees. And so if we focus just on the young Oregon population, unfortunately, we're actually farther from 40-40-20 than we are if we look at Oregonians as a whole or adult Oregonians as a whole. So just to be clear, it's not some sort of trick to boost the numbers. We'd actually see that we've got pretty significant gaps when we look at our young Oregonians.
So my question is, would we be talking about people who are 25 and younger? Would we be talking about 30 and younger? Where would we set the limit with respect to who we're looking at?
Yeah, Senator Roblin, members of the committee, that is not described in statute, and we would work with our stakeholders and others to identify where is an appropriate point to set that. I think this is a positive thing. Generally, with respect to 40-40-20 as it exists today and its measurement, we've not been too precise about definitions, if only because this is not meant to be a precise sort of accountability goal. You know, take out of your mind the Department of Education's highly precise and high stakes goal of measurement of graduation rates for high schools. Right, it's a very technical and very important formula with very clear definitions. We're attempting to bring somewhat more clarity, but we're not proposing that we make 40-40-20 a highly rigorous, very clearly defined. We would have to go through, for example, hundreds of different certificates that are awarded by private and public institutions in education, say, does this qualify for the middle 40? Does that? We don't do that today, and we're not suggesting that we should. This should remain, 40-40-20 should remain a rough yardstick for measuring Oregon's progress towards educational attainment for all Oregonians.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Thanks. So there's no one else signed up to speak to this bill, so we're going to close the House Bill 2311. And now we're back on House Bill 2666. So let's have, is it Candolin, Johnson, Nikki,
something.
Amen? Okay, good. And Lisa DeMoris?
Lena.
Lena, it's an N. Hi, Lena.
Lena, please print.
They did print. That's the sad part.
That was a nice try. Senator.
Thank you. I appreciate that statement. It made me feel good. So, thanks.
Yeah. Hello, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee. My name is Candolin Johnson. I'm a fourth-year senior at Oregon State University. I'm also a member of the student government there as the Executive Director of Government Relations, and I serve as the Vice Chair of the Board of Directors for the Oregon Students Association. I've had the privilege to be a part of student government both at Lynn Benton Community College as the student body president and now at OSU, where both organizations were given the responsibility and autonomy to control their own student fees in order to give much-needed services to students. This is the most important process that we do as an organization, and we wouldn't be fully representing students if we didn't take full ownership in that process. The ability to set and allocate the student fee would open doors to an education experience that students at public universities already have and community college students deserve. It is entirely necessary for student governments to have control over their fees for a few key reasons. The first is that student governments, in essence, were formed on many campuses like OSU due to the need for an avenue for students to voice where their money should and should not be spent. It's an entirely different process than tuition setting, as someone mentioned before. And the student fee setting process is student-centered and student-ran, which is completely different than tuition. The second is that giving student fee autonomy to students helps develop leaders who understand accountability, how to allocate a public budget, how to communicate the process, and implement changes in our institutions to reflect the needs of those that they're trying to serve. The third is, without autonomy, students have little to no say on how and what their money should be spent on. Administration, specifically at community colleges, are willing to just wait students out for 2 years. This is particularly problematic because the basic needs of students can't be met if there's such high turnover at community colleges. The fourth comment I would like to make is that student fees that fund services and programs on our campuses also increase retention and graduation rates. These can include safer and expanded nighttime transportation for commuter campuses, expanded library hours for studying, food pantries, expansion of student jobs, and other services that students desperately need. At LBCC, the food pantry that thousands of students use every year is completely funded by student fees and was voted on by the student body as an essential service. At OSU, fees meant the investment in our cultural resource centers after students organized for a space of their own and voted to use these fee dollars for that purpose. When asked why students want to raise fees, the answer is that they may not. But students like to be given the chance to decide on how and where the money is spent. Otherwise, student government turns into nothing more than a high school prom committee, where given tasks by administrators without any say or where that money is going. Students may decide to cut spending if given control, or they may increase them, but it would be up to the student body to decide that. At LBCC, a democratic system was set in place where any increase has to be voted on by a certain percentage of the entire student body before an increase can be made. I want to make clear, the passage of this bill does not guarantee that student fees will go up at community colleges, but rather gives students the choice for their fee to go up or down, or to stay the same. Therefore, the passage of this bill does not mean an automatic fee increase, but rather gives students control of their own activity fee. In many cases, this would transfer the funds that are already allocated to student government into control of a student government group. This is mirroring what university students already have. I urge the committee to support HB 2666, which sounds worse than it is, obviously, and give community college students the same leadership opportunities and voice as the rest of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
You next. Members of the committee, my name is Nikki Amon, and I'm a current student at Oregon State University and as a transfer from Lynn Benton Community College, just like Candolin. We actually served on the same staff in student government during our time at LBCC, and one of the things that I cherished the most about my time at LBCC was that I was part of a community college that had student fee autonomy and was able to make decisions about what we were going to use funds that students entrusted us to make decisions on. The best part about that is that when students have autonomy over their fees, they get to decide for themselves and have students who they appointed to make decisions for them make those decisions, and gives students more power and trust that, you know, we are adults and that we can handle these kinds of decisions. Something that I distinctly remember about having student fee autonomy was that we were able to make decisions that bettered students' lives that honestly I don't think that administration really could know, because it's been a while since many of them have been students. So for some examples of the kinds of things that we use student fees for is, like Candolin said, the food pantry is very well used on our campus, and by being able to use that money to help students with food insecurity is a thing that I took very seriously during my time on student government at LBCC. Something else is that we provide funding to student groups. So students are allocating money for the groups that they care about. So our GSA and our Students for Life groups on campus are very active and do events every term, and they wouldn't be able to do that without that money. And finally, something else that we use our funding for is an annual event called Diversity Day. It's a huge event that many people from all around the town and in other towns come to on LBCC's campus. It celebrates all the different cultures that are there on our campus. And that's really important. And again, we would not be able to do that without the student fees that we are able to use. In short, it was important to me that we had that access, and it makes me sad to think that there are still community colleges that basically have no say in what they can use their money for. Like Candolin said, it's basically like high school leadership, where the administration tells you what you're going to do, what you're going to use money for, and that money might not be best allocated, especially if students have zero say in where that's going. I can't imagine how difficult it would be to provide services that students truly care about if students have no say in those funds. So I urge you to support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, Senator Gelser, Senator Cruz. Thank you so much for listening to us today. I wanted to kind of provide an illustration. My name's Lena DeMorais. I got you. So my name's Lena DeMorais. I served on student government with Nikki and Candolin from 2015 to 2016. And the past year and a half, I have the pleasure to serve as an officer in our Veterans Club, which means that I've been able to see how incidental fees are allocated, but also what they can do. I did want to echo a couple points here. I believe that student government exists as both a service to students, but also a way to develop leadership, to teach students about fiduciary duties, and to do so with accountability. We work closely with administration at LBCC, but we still do have a lot of autonomy. What's really great about student government is that we maintain constant communication with our student body. We're aware of their needs and wants, and anything that is done is vetted through the body as a whole. excuse me. One of the things that I want to talk about is give more of a picture of the myriad of things that incidental fees allow us to do. When I working with the Veterans Club, even though I wanted to point out our school also requires, or not our school, I should say student government also requires clubs to fund independently, so it's not just incidental fees. So for instance, the Veterans Club, we funded independently for our lounge. However, we had a number of other things that we wanted to do, and so we've been able to petition the student government to create assertiveness and conflict resolution trainings with certified counselors. We have had soup kitchen endeavors. We've sent delegations to the National Conference and Student Veterans of America. And then most importantly, recently, last month, we lost a member of our club to suicide. And we were tasked with having a quick turnaround and figuring out how are we going to do the memorial? How are we going to get the resources that we need? And the truth is, administration has a lot of responsibilities already. Their time is very much accounted for. It's difficult to be able to walk into a meeting and ask for money. However, our school student government meets twice a week, meaning that I was able to, with other representatives of my club, go straight to our leadership in the student government and say, these are our needs. This is what we would like to do for the family. This is the ceremony that we would like to honor his memory. And it just really gives a sense of inclusivity. It allows for a back and forth between the student body, and as Kennelyn pointed out, that level of autonomy is really empowering to our student body, and it allows them to think, well, this is my money, this is my voice, and use it in that way. So for all those reasons and so many more that I could sit here and espouse ad nauseum, I really do urge you all to approve House Bill 2666.
Any questions for this group? I guess I have two. Number one, community colleges have a lot more, how did the other person put it, alternatives, or students.
Non-traditional
students.
Like myself, yes.
Yes, like you. And, you know, have you had a conversation with them when you were at those schools to make sure they feel included? Because sometimes they don't feel that included because the people around them look different than them.
if I may, Chair Roblin, absolutely. We actually pride ourselves greatly in ensuring that every group represented in our campuses has a voice, is heard. You know, in my Veterans Club, we have a lot of non-traditional students. Actually, as a veteran, they are all non-traditional students. You know, most of them have been in service for however long, and so they do have a different perspective. And honestly, I think that that is such an advantage on a campus. When we served on student government, we've always had at least someone who had experience in accounting. When you have an older, and I don't want to say more mature as in, you know, emotionally mature, but even more aged as far as life experience, it really does allow for more mentorship opportunities, even within student government, because everybody has that experience. So I would say absolutely, we always consider their requests and we do make the effort to reach out.
Okay, and my last question is, since the only ones that I see sitting in front of me right now are all from the same community college that already has it, mm-hmm. are you trying to impose this on other people who don't want it?
So, Chair Roblin, if I may, I have actually sat in with discussions with the Oregon Community College Student Association regarding student fee autonomy. They are currently in the process of rebuilding their constitution and bylaws and don't have the ability to lobby. And so I just wanted to point out that, yes, we are in communication with other community colleges.
Okay. Thank you. That is helpful for me.
He didn't ask if you were in communication. He asked if you were trying to push it.
I will say that we absolutely value autonomy and prefer that, you know, the decision be made, but also would like to say there is support.
Okay. There's a yes. politician there.
Yeah. So it might be, yeah. Yeah, Senator Lithicum and then Senator.
Thank you. The with regard to using fees for services and giving students the freedom to participate in how those monies are spent, how do you propose handling individuals who would rather not spend their money in that way? I was under the impression this was mandatory.
So I can speak to that, Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Lithingham. So the thing about fees, and I was talking to some people earlier, for example, at Western Oregon, there were several times that someone was telling me that a fee that the student government had this great idea. And sometimes when you're in student government, you think that you know what's going on. I think a lot of people who serve in government think they know what people want. And then they present this great idea that they're really excited about, and the students kept voting it down. And so their fee didn't increase, and that service was not provided. I think that a part of this is that if the fee is going to increase, it needs to be approved. It needs to be a service that student government convinces the body that this is something that you'll want to pay for. And so when you do that, these services, they are mandatory. When you're a new student and you weren't a part of that process to begin with, yeah, that's a mandatory fee you have to pay. But in order for that fee to accrue, in order for that fee to increase or to gain new fees onto that, you need to have approval of the current student body, or at least the representatives, in my case at Oregon State, where there's so many more students that you can't like run a campaign every time you want to increase something about everything because there's so many fees, right? But at a smaller community college, there's a way for you to find out from the whole student body as to whether this is a service they want to pay for. And I think that's the key difference between, say, tuition, which is mandatory, and student fees, which is mandatory. Tuition, I don't get a say in whether that increases or not, but I do get a say as to whether my student fees are increased or whether it can decrease. I know some colleges very critically examine their student fees every single year to think, where are we spending this money? Is it going towards services that students still care about and still want? And so a lot of times that means cutting some programs that aren't happening anymore or increasing others. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. It leads to a follow-on with regard to the ability for students to pick and choose and respond in a positive way. I see the free market getting a short shrift here in terms of if I really am looking for autonomy, the best autonomy I can have is with my own finances, my own resources, my own job, my own whatever. And following on with that, I see the potential downside for a large pot in the community college arena. There's odd times, odd places, odd locations, not all on campus, et cetera. And so students may all of a sudden have a fee, even underprivileged students, students of color, those people who feel who aren't on campus all the time participating in student government as the three of you are. They're out there, but they're getting dinged in their pocketbook, and they're already struggling to make the pocketbook work in the limited environment they have. So can you speak? That was a whole series of items, but they're all related to finances.
Mm-hmm. All right, Senator or Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithingham, if I may address that partially. And I just would like to make sure that I understand, is this kind of a concern of tyranny of majority and there not being a voice?
Absolutely.
I think that is a very valid concern, and that is one that we have had at Lynn Benton. We've been used as a pilot for a number of reasons, but before anything is presented to the student body for a vote, open forums are held in which dissent is actually encouraged. There are even times when we will bring in a debate club to provide an opposing point of view if there aren't students interested in voicing it. I believe that the democratic process is the best process that we have been able to find so far, but those concerns do not fall on deaf ears, and that's why there is such a constant communication between student body, student government, and administration.
Yeah. And is there a percentage required for passage?
Yeah.
Yes.
What is that percentage?
Is it 16? I think it's...
Yeah, 16. Yeah, I believe it's 16% of the student body.
I meant majority.
Okay. So...
Like 51% passes it, or 66%, or 75?
Okay, so whether it's a simple
majority.
Two-thirds,
three-fifths... 51. What are,
yeah.
You know, some majority 51. Of student body has to pass these increases. I'm looking for that number.
Yeah, that's 51%, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's a simple majority.
Yeah, it's a simple majority rule.
Small minority to be in the majority.
Can I add something?
Chair Roblin, Senator Lithicum. So something else that we should mention is that these the money that goes into the student activity fee on LBCC's campus was previously already tacked on to tuition, and the administration would take a percentage of that money and divvy it up to student governments, which many community colleges around Oregon still follow. So it's not necessarily a matter of a new increase to the bill that students didn't know was going to happen and couldn't account for. It's something that already costs something, and students will have the autonomy to decide if they want to make cuts for. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for any of you. Do you think that it is appropriate for power to be inequitably distributed across the state, where some communities get more and some communities get less?
Chair Roblin and Senator Gelser, I would say no. I don't think that's appropriate.
And what district do you all live in?
We live in your district.
Rest my case.
Okay. So thank you all for being here. We have three more people I'm going to hear from, and some of our people have to leave, so thank you. So Nick Carmack, Alex Bell Johnson, and Mariana Fedoris. I think I said that right. She left. Okay. Thanks for waiting through this and being here and being from someplace other than Lynn Benton Community College.
Hello, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, and members of the committee. My name is Alex Bell Johnson, and I am the current student body president for the Portland Community College Cascade campus. I have spent this academic year, at least a good chunk of it, working on our student activity fee task force. The combination of the minimum wage increase and declining enrollment was threatening to strain our resources to a point of collapse. Additionally, we continued to hear from hungry and housing insecure students that they were not receiving the resources necessary to stay at PCC. So our task force focused on increasing the student activity fee to do the most good for the most students. By increasing the fee by just 95 cents per credit hour, we created housing grants and food banks on all four of our campuses. We increased our student government funding to hire more students and provide relevant, well-funded programming. And finally, we increased every diversity retention center, such as the Women's Resource Center or the Veterans Resource Center, by 150%. All of this was driven by student research, feedback, and advocacy. This process has taught me the importance of fee autonomy for student governments. Within just a year, we addressed multiple issues that PCC students face daily. This change would have not been possible had we worked with our general fund to seek means to address these issues. Due to low support from the state, our general fund is directed primarily to salaries and operating expenses, as is the case at most community colleges in our state. The only way we could address these student issues that we saw every day on our campus was through our SAF. This bill does not guarantee that student fees will go up at community colleges. Students can choose to increase their fee or to have it stay the same or even decrease the fee if they see fit. The raise that we pursued was methodical and required serious consideration of the cost impact. Our constituents hold us to the same standard as I'm sure yours do. They challenged what we saw as necessary at every public hearing and shaped the eventual raise we implemented. It was difficult, but the result has been well worth the work. Watching students go to class hungry and feeling powerless to change it is the only thing that I can imagine being more difficult than raising our student activity fee. I encourage you to guarantee this opportunity to all community colleges in our state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dear Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, and at this point, Senator Cruz, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Nick Carmack. I'm the current president of Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society and the incoming student body president at PCC Cascade. I'm here to tell you why I believe you should vote yes on House Bill 2666. It is extremely important to me that students have autonomy over their own student fees because I've seen the impacts it has on student lives. Being involved with student life and leadership has provided me the space to learn the invaluable skills of advocacy, community organizing, and time management. I contribute the majority of my growth and my college experience to my involvement in ASPCC, which is funded by student fees. Students know students' needs better than anyone else. And allowing us to have autonomy over our own fees allows us to spend money on the services we deem necessary. Because we have the ability to lower or raise our fee, we can choose to allocate the funds to specific programs or services to meet the needs of students. The National Student Campaign for Hunger and Homelessness published research in 2016 that shows 48% respondents reported food insecurity in the previous 30 days, including 22% with very low levels of food security that qualify them as hungry. Although our administration has not put funds toward this issue yet, we now have student position on every campus to help with food and housing insecurity and to run our food pantries. We also have been able to set aside money to give students in an emergency situation non-repayable grants. We also use this money to promote sustainability. We have instituted a bike program where students can rent a bike for $15 per term. We also have a program called the Green Initiative Fund, where any student, staff, or faculty can apply for a grant which allocates funds to a project that increases the amount of renewable energy used on campus, increase the energy efficiency, and reduce the amount of waste created by our college. The resource centers on campus are also a place that are funded by student fees. Some of the most marginalized groups can come together at these resource centers. The Queer Resource Center is a place where I personally know I can go and I can feel comfortable and safe. I know that the Women's and Veterans Resource Center, as well as the Multicultural Center, and many of our diversity retention clubs are places where students who otherwise don't feel comfortable on campus can go when they need community or resources. All this is possible because we have the autonomy to set and allocate our own student fees. So please vote yes on House Bill 2666. Thank you.
Any questions? I guess my only question for you is, in PCC, is each campus its own deal with different fees, or is it the whole?
So the way that it works is that we collect a student fee from all students who participate in Portland Community College, as long as they're a credit student. And then from that point, we budget at a district level based on enrollment figures at each campus. And then each campus has the autonomy to decide how they should divvy up their piece of the student activity fee based on the needs that they see fit for their different communities. Okay. Yeah, it's a big Thank system.
You. Yeah, it is a big system. Since you're the largest higher ed organization in the state, it's not a simple one.
No.
Certainly not.
Any other questions for this group? Thank you very much for being here, and thanks for sharing your perspectives and to find out that there's at least two community colleges that allow autonomy.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close our public hearing on 2666. And committee, we'll be back here on Thursday. The following Thursday, we will not have a committee meeting because we're having our other group meet. And this is also, we'll start having public hearings and possible work sessions fairly soon, if not next session, because we're getting close to the timeline for bills to be heard in the Education Committee. So with that, we're going to close our Education Committee meeting today. Thank you all for being here, and thank you, Senator Lithicum, for taking care of the meeting at the beginning.